It's the Mike Novak Show, Chicago's, and quite possibly the country's only gardening, environment, and green living show, streaming right here, well, wherever you are. So let's all sing along. Are y'all ready? 3, 2, and 1.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
Well, yes, they are. And welcome to this kind of the first, second week. Second week of March, and stuff is happening. I have to admit, I'm kind of excited. Went outside in my yard the other day, and there were things shooting up through the earth. Kind of like a science fiction movie, except they were daffodils and crocuses. And it means that a couple of things are happening, one of which is the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, which is coming to Navy Pier this coming weekend, the 14th of March. That website, if you're interested, is chicagoflower.com. And as I have been promoting on the show, the Good Food Festival and Conference, March 19th to 21st, that website is goodfoodfestivals.com. So lots going on. To start, I have a buddy of mine who's putting together, well, I actually had him on the show not too long ago because I was, as I was making my transition from terrestrial radio to internets, I was putting some of the best of 2014 on, and he happened to be one of the best interviews of the year, last year. And that is Dave Coulter from Osage, Inc. And the reason is because he has introduced a concept to me that I was not familiar with, which is the idea of hedgerows. I've known about margins along farms and land where biodiversity could occur, but he is promoting this in a way that I really like and appreciate. And he's got a conference coming up at the Chicago Botanic Garden. That starts the show. Then we get to the 11th Annual Good Food Festival and Conference. And for that, I have Rhea Carr from Mint Creek Farm. Mint Creek is participating in Family Farm's Good Food Business Accelerator right now. And that's part of the whole three-day festival that's going on at the UIC Forum in Chicago. It's really pretty cool. As a matter of fact, in a second, I'll tell you about how you can get tickets. But Rhea talks to me about her farm, about her dad, who's the poet farmer, about the band of farmers. And when we say band of farmers, we mean actually performing on stage, which they will be doing in Chicago very soon. It's really cool stuff. So that's on the show today. The other thing you're going to notice is commercials are back. I don't mean that everybody likes to hear commercials, but you know what? They're great people with great products. And a lot of you will recognize a lot of them from my show before on terrestrial radio. So welcome to the Mike Novak Show. We will get to Dave Coulter in just a second. But first, as I mentioned before, the 11th Annual Good Food Festival and Conference is happening March 19th through 21st at Chicago's UIC Forum. And I've got some tickets for you if you're interested. I'm talking free, okay? And I'll tell you how to get them in just a second. It brings consumers, producers, buyers, top chefs, experts, investors together to celebrate the fast-growing local and sustainable food movement, which I talk a lot about on this show. The public is, of course, welcomed to the family-friendly festival with more than 150 farmers, artisans, and other exhibitors to meet you and offer samples. That's one of the best parts, actually, samples. Learn from the experts during the chef demos and sessions, such as design and grow an edible garden, artisan bread making, a discussion on the future of food with media experts. If you're interested in gardening and environmental issues, check out the Good Food Commons, where the discussions are about DIY categories like make, grow, raise, preserve, compost, and community building. And there are sessions like Square Foot Gardening, Good Bugs, Bad Bugs, Composting 101, and workshops on canning, pickling, and more. You can even sign up for an urban farm bus tour. The Friday night Localicious party, and I have to say, it's one of the top annual tasting events in Chicago, where food from restaurants like Big Jones, I interviewed Paul Feuerbach last week on this show, which brings us to the idea of tickets. I still have tickets to give away to the Good Food Festival. So all you have to do, send me an email. Write to me at mike@mikenowak.net, mikenowak.net, and say you want a couple of tickets and you'll get them. Well, at least the first few people who do that. So send me an email.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Sound red alert. Shields up. Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe, author of my favorite children's stories.
Captain, I am attempting to access a copy of the masterpiece. It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
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 Yes, Mr. Watt.
Yes, Captain. Aroundtheblockpress.com.
How many times can I say it?
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
I'm pleased to be back with Dave Coulter from Osage, Inc. What's the website again, Dave?
www.osagegroup.com, Mike.
Okay, osagegroup.com, if you're trying to track him down. Now, the name might sound familiar because last year he was on my program to talk about hedgerows, and in fact, I took that conversation and used it as one of the best of 2014, so you might have heard something earlier this year. So when I ran into Dave in 2015, we were at the MLK
Sustainability
and Food Justice Weekend,
right,
at KAM Isaiah Israel. And he told me that he was working on a seminar, a project, to talk about hedgerows and the importance of hedgerows in the 21st century. I was very interested, and then I got some information from you the other day, and it's actually coming to fruition, isn't it?
That's right. The symposium, it's basically a hedgerow-themed symposium, and it's going to be taking place at the end of March on the 27th. The symposium will be a part of the annual meetings for the Society for Ecological Restoration, their Midwest and Great Lakes chapter, and this will be held at the Botanic Gardens on the 27th through the 29th of March. And the symposium itself, we're going to have five speakers from around, mainly around Illinois, but from Minnesota as well, five different speakers that are going to really speak to the value of hedgerows, field margins, in the modern, you know, the contemporary landscape. And hopefully this, the five speakers will really cover the history of these features as well in Illinois from, say, the 19th century on to today, the 21st century.
Let's back it up just a second, because you and I, before we started, before I hit the record button on this, and I were having a little conversation about hedgerows and how many people have no idea what a hedgerow is.
Exactly.
So what is a hedgerow?
Well, yeah, Americans, for the most part, it's a word that's a little bit puzzling to them, but hedgerows are features in the landscape. If you think of farm boundaries, that's probably the best way that people can visualize these things. You know, once upon a time, really hundreds, thousands of years ago, especially over in Europe, you know, these things were created to delineate, really to hold in livestock and to delineate property boundaries. I think many of your listeners have probably seen photographs of England and the British Isles where they have these, you know, green fields and they kind of have these rectilinear farm boundaries, you know, divvying up the landscape. So that's, these hedgerows were really designed with a purpose for, you know, keeping the animals in, keeping your neighbors out, that kind of thing.
That's the way we work it in America.
Yeah,
keep the neighbors
right.
out. How come I can see my neighbors?
That's right. We always, you know, we want to find better ways to do that. But what happened over in England, to pick one country, is that these kind of rough edges, these field margins, became niches, habitat for a lot of smaller animals, you know, birds, insects, small mammals, what have you, that needed habitat in these areas that had been basically greatly changed, agriculturally speaking. So, you know, these animals, a lot of these animals had nowhere else to go, so they wound up taking up refuge in these hedgerows. So they became refuges, habitat, almost by accident.
Uh-huh.
You know, they weren't, in other words, these hedgerows weren't designed to give the sparrows a place to live, but that's what happened to them.
And, of course, the kinds of material that was planted had to be something substantial to keep, if you were keeping livestock in place. So lots of woody material, but also herbaceous material was planted in hedgerows or sprang up, or moved to, or seeded itself within hedgerows. Is that correct?
Exactly. The way these things were built, and I'm talking about many centuries ago, was done with woody plants, was done sometimes with stone walls. I'm talking about in the old country now. And they were also, the craft and the art of hedge laying is where people would come around and basically reconfigure these woody plants, you know, take with a axe and a saw and basically weave them together to create almost like living fences. And that's a craft, that's an art form that really never quite caught on in the United States because, you know, European settlement came here, you know, speaking of Illinois anyway, you know, European settlement came here later. And by that time, you know, it wasn't too long after that the wire fence became.
But before that, though, one of the plants that was used was the namesake of your company, Osage Orange.
That's true.
Because the wood is very tough.
Yeah, and it's a thorny. Yeah, exactly. Osage Orange is a plant that was used as hedgerow materials. It's actually a native plant further south of Chicago, anyway, and it's very thorny. And so what happened was it was meant to be kept more like it's a shrub plant. It wasn't. When they planted these things, they weren't, and that would keep the animals in. I mean, they weren't designed or idealized to grow up into trees the way we see them now, like the remnant hedgerows that are now like Osage Orange trees. That's just because they grew up into the tree form that they want to be naturally. But that's not what the intent was at the get-go.
So here we are in the 21st century, and as you mentioned, a lot of these were torn down because there were fences. There was not even a need to plant them. But we did have some hedgerows here in the United States. And the same biodiversity came to those hedgerows as did in other parts of the world. Is that right?
That's correct.
So your idea for the 21st century, and this is what I find really fascinating, is why not go back to hedgerows? Because they don't take up a lot of space. They don't. How wide do they have? Does a hedgerow have to be?
Well, that's really that's a good point. That you know, if we were going to redesign these things today, with the range of plant materials, native, and I want to emphasize native plant materials,
because
especially
they didn't always have native plant materials in the hedgerows.
Exactly. I mean, when people came here, they were basically planting anything that would grow quickly and do the job. But I think I think we've all had plenty of bad experiences with invasive species now, so I absolutely want to emphasize using native plants, and we'll come back to that, maybe why we want to use native plants for native insects and pollinators and things like that. But to get back to the size and the width question, a person could really design whatever they wanted, but you know, with any kind of native plant materials they like. You know, it could be take like an ornamental type of tree, like a viburnum or a witch hazel, something like this, you know, that wouldn't get much more than, say, 10 feet wide. You know, or you could go smaller, or you could go wider. I mean, but the key thing to remember is having some sensitivity to mature size of the plant, for one thing, and then keeping in mind that there may need to be some management in the future. It's not just the kind of thing, like any other landscape feature, you can't necessarily walk away from it once it's planted.
Well, that gets us to the idea of hedgerow design. And by the way, I'm talking to Dave Coulter from Osage Inc. About hedgerows. Can you design? Is there anybody who designs hedgerows?
Oh, of course. When I talk to the landscape architects I know, and we'll have these conversations for fun, really, you know, because nobody,
nobody's actually buying them, right?
It's kind of a new idea, and you know, and I think it's gonna really fall on progressive thinking people to implement these things, and that's happening too, and hopefully we'll talk about that in a little bit, but you know, yeah, they can be designed. They can be designed like any other garden can be designed. I mean, why not? It's not that complicated to do.
But you don't pick. You're not going to go to a library or you go online and here's the standard design for hedgerows.
No.
You can't find anything like can you?
You'd probably have to go over to the Newberry Library or somewhere like that to go digging through the old farming magazines to get some ideas. But you would basically have to work with the size of the plant and working with the space that you need to fill in. And
the reason I ask you is because it's something else that you and I talked about earlier, which is, let's say someone decides to put a hedgerow on their property, and you would need a certain size of property, obviously, maybe farmland, maybe something else, I don't know. But this is something that still will need to be maintained, and it's going to change over time, isn't it?
That's right. You know, one of the things you can see still on occasion is if you go out along the highways, every so often you'll see rows of shrubs were planted by the highway people, the highway departments, and they just kind of like, you know, let them go. And that was mainly done, I think, is for snow fences, for, you know, to create a barrier for the snow. You'll
right.
see them a lot, oftentimes on the north side of the expressways around here. And, you know, and some of those were just, they've got enough room to spread out into, like, I'm thinking about like one plant I think they used quite a bit of was honeysuckle. Well, that can spread out to be like, you know, 10, 12 feet wide, and they
know. And you're talking about the non-native honeysuckle?
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly, oh boy,
for sure.
That was
yeah,
a good idea.
Well, you know, like I say, we've all come a long way, I think, in understanding some of the pros and cons of using, you know, non-native plants. So,
yeah. Especially cons.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get back to the idea then of, you know, design is one thing, and there might be a design reason for putting in a hedgerow on a property, but really what we're talking about is biodiversity and what it does to preserve our insects, our mammals, our birds. We're talking at a time when, and I keep hammering this, and there are people who get frustrated because they say there's too much emphasis placed on the decline of the monarch butterfly, the one species, because there are a lot of butterflies that are under threat. And I understand that, but I think the monarch is a good place to hang your hat, because exactly. everybody knows what a sure. monarch is. So sure. those folks, I say, get over it. If we can save this one species, we can save other species as well. And one of the things that's happening with the monarch is we're losing things like hedgerows. We're losing the corridors of biodiversity from north to south, from east to west. They're just disappearing because we are developing our lands. We are taking every last acre and every last strip to produce more corn or soybeans or whatever. Mm-hmm. We're using Roundup and making milkweed disappear. Is this something that you can fight back with by planting hedgerows?
Oh, I think so. I believe last year when we chatted, you know, there are folks out at one example is there are folks out at Iowa State University that are working on prairie strips, for example, that herbaceous plants. But that's one of the attempts to bring biodiversity, to bring say beneficial insects back into the landscape. You know, your point about monarchs is a good one, because it has become a focal point, and I think it has become a focal point because of their decline. But I think that's probably a good thing, because if people are willing to invest in the biodiversity plantings, let's say, that will also benefit hopefully a whole lot of other species that aren't so well known.
But getting specifically to monarchs, let me think. A hedgerow might actually benefit a monarch.
Sure.
A place of shelter.
Exactly.
To over, you know, they...
I mean, that's right. I mean, and the thing is, if you were talking about, like, design and things like that, and one of the things I'd like to mention, too, is think of all the places in the landscape where we could use visual buffers, where maybe you're trying to screen something.
Your neighbors. I keep going back to that.
Your neighbors must be nice people, but if you think about it, there's all kinds of applications where maybe these kinds of plantings could be done, and then with any kind of sensitivity, they could be, it's almost like they're doing double duty, you know, like one of the things when I talk about this topic, the hedgerow topic, with other people, some people think about food plants, woody food plants, permaculture, that kind of thing. You know, why not create a buffer, a visual buffer, that's not only going to screen whatever you want screened, but will also maybe produce food or produce habitat or produce, you know, you fill in the blank. So mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of respects these hedgerow type features can be seen as just good landscape planning. You know, it's just, you know, pick your word how you want to do it. You know, the word, as we've mentioned before, you know, I think the word hedgerow stumps a lot of people sometimes.
Well, maybe you need a new name for it. I want a new name for milkweed simply because right. people call it a weed. Let's call it monarch plant.
Exactly. A lot of time it is marketing, but you know, it's there's a lot of names for these things.
That's Dave Coulter from Osage, Inc. We're talking about a hedgerows. Let me get back up just one second for one more thing about the monarch and hedgerows.
Sure. Right.
I would imagine that if you plant a hedgerow and, you know, whatever natives you have in there, maybe it's hawthorns or something like that, you're not planting milkweed under it, but it would occur
to... Why not?
Okay.
Why not do a mixture of woody plants and herbaceous plants?
Well, that's what I was going to say, that you could still have milkweed on the margins of your hedgerow. Well,
sure, why not? Absolutely.
Right. So it could be not only a place of shelter for monarchs, but a source of food.
Absolutely. Like I say, and that's what I think...
A place to breed.
Coming back to your design, I mean, if you look at some of the resources, I mean, that's one wonderful thing about the Internet. We all have access to resources now for all these different plants that attract different kinds of animals. So if you're interested in attracting songbirds, for example, there are plants for that. If you're interested in attracting butterflies, there are plants for that. And I would by no means limit this to just woody plants. I would make it a mixture. You know, if I was king, and we're getting close, we all laugh.
Yeah, I know. It is funny.
Yeah, look for my crown. No, but I mean, I would definitely, I mean, if I was, had the wherewithal, I would do a mixture of plants that, you know, woody and herbaceous plants that, you know, suited the purpose I was trying to fill.
So enter the Society for Ecological Restoration, and they have branches all over the world, including in the Midwest. You can go to www.ser.org, and you can find the various branches, including the Midwest Great Lakes branch, and or chapter, I guess they call them chapters.
Right.
You can always find this information on my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show. All those links are there. So if you hear it pass by very quickly here, go check it out on my website and it'll be there. So the SER is having its 7th annual chapter meeting for the Midwest Great Lakes chapter at the Chicago Botanic Garden, March 27th to 29th. And you managed to score a symposium about hedgerows.
Yeah, that's pretty, I'm pretty excited about it because I really want to thank the Midwest Great Lakes chapter of the SER for, I would say, having the vision to allow the symposium. I mean, there's going to be three symposiums that day on Friday the 27th.
All competing, of course.
Yes, but you want to come to the hedgerow.
Of course.
the hedgerow symposium. No, actually, this is an idea I started working on last fall. And one of the organizers suggested that I, you know, put together a symposium on this topic. And so I did. I wrote a little proposal, and they approved it. And I've got five really excellent speakers coming on the 27th to talk about different aspects of this this idea, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they're from around the Midwest. I've got Steve Swanson from Glenview Park District, Adrian Fisher from Triton College, Rhonda Faree, who is in charge of the Illinois State Master Naturalist Program with the Extension Service, U of I Extension Service, Jim Kleinwachter from the Conservation Foundation, and lastly, but not least, Wendy Caldwell from Monarch Joint Venture up in Minnesota is going to be speaking there as well. And these five speakers are really going to take in, I hope, the history of hedgerows in northern Illinois and in the upper Midwest, really from the early pioneer days up until the 21st century. So we're going to be talking about, you know, the obviously the advantages of thinking about using these things, but also some of the challenges. You know, I want to caution people a little bit about using the word corridor too much.
Okay.
Because corridors, in some of the things I've read, you know, these things are very complex. You know, and there are people that will also say, well, you know, some of these, one animal's corridor can be another animal's barrier. Mm. And I guess one analogy I use to make that work in my mind is look at a river. You know, a river is a great corridor if you're a bluegill, but it's a lousy corridor if you're an opossum. You know, that's not going to do you any good, that river. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are complex. We live in a complex world. And so I try personally to say hedgerows are good for habitat. They're good for niches, you know, home. Provide a little home for these creatures.
Well, it sounds like actually we need to do a little more research on hedgerows and the benefits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I think that's what a lot of people are doing now. It's been kind of, the research has been kind of ongoing over in the, you know, over in Europe and the British Isles in particular about the various benefits and the environmental benefits. Ecosystem services is another area that you and I haven't even really talked about. You know, how do these things help soak up nitrogen, soak up carbon, things like this. You know, that we look at ecosystem services for in urban forestry for trees, for mature trees. Well, these types of plantings have the same services, have the same kind of benefits that can be quantified. In Europe, they're way ahead of us on this because they just are. That's their history. That's their history of their appreciation of their landscape. You know, I think in the United States, we're catching up. And there are people, I think as we discussed last year, you know, there are people out in around the United States that have really started looking at this, you know, more from a research standpoint. And I think now, and what when I started working on this personally, the monarch butterfly crisis really hadn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. So now, it almost seems like, I wouldn't say it's perfect timing, but it seems like, you know, this idea has always been there. You know, now we just happen to have a situation where one iconic insect is in trouble and people are scrambling to try and find a solution, and rightfully so.
Well, the conference, again, is Cultivating Ecological Restoration Within Human-Dominated Landscapes. A mouthful.
That's us.
That's us. Yes, we are human-dominated landscapes. And it's the 7th annual chapter meeting for the Society for Ecological Restoration Midwest Great Lakes chapter, March 27th to 29th. But your presentation is on the 27th, correct?
Right. And the title of the symposium is called Life Along the Edges, A Discussion of the Value of Field Margins, Hedgerows, and Buffers in the Modern Landscape.
And you can find that information on my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show if you want a link, you want to be part of this. It sounds like it's going to be, and I assume it's open to the public.
There isn't a, you have to, it's open to anybody, but you do have to pay to attend.
Well, yes, yeah, of course. Yes, sure, yeah. Right.
Yeah, there's a conference fee and things like that. But it's definitely open to the public, but, you know, check for registration fees at through the SER website.
Well, congratulations, Dave. It sounds like you're making progress, and people are starting to pay attention to the idea of hedgerows.
Nothing like overnight success, Mike.
I'm sure we'll be talking again very soon.
I hope so.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakenings Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. So if your sustainable business is anywhere in Lake or Cook County, we want you to be part of our magazine. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakenings than any other magazine to help lead happier, healthier, and greener lives. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Natural Awakenings is distributed in more than 1,000 Chicagoland locations, and our readers are looking for products and services just like yours. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
This is a time of year when many of us have resigned ourselves to the idea that snow is a permanent part of the landscape. And then, magically, in the course of about a week, as it happened this week in Chicago, we realize that there are things called seasons. And the one called spring, which lasts for about 3 days in this part of the country, is sneaking up on us. It's time to reach for the March-April issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. You might grab it this year because there are articles about wildflowers, how to help bees, birds, and butterflies. But come on. Most of you grab this one because it comes with the 2015 Resource Guide, which is a handy booklet about everything horticultural in the Chicago area. A good place to pick up this issue, order a subscription, and chat with your favorite gardening columnist is the Chicago Flower and Garden Show at Navy Pier from March 14th through 22nd. I'm going to be there off and on at the Chicagoland Gardening Magazine booth number 125, selling and signing copies of my book, Attack of the Killer Asparagus. So stop by. But if you can't get there, go to chicagolandgardening.com or call 888-265-3600 for a subscription. 888-265-3600.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545, or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
Thank you. second in our series of interviews with folks who are participating in the Good Food Festival coming up in Chicago from March 19th through the 21st. What would good food be like without farms? Well, we wouldn't have it, frankly. And I'm happy to have Rhea Carr on the phone with me. She is the sales manager for Mint Creek Farm. Good day to you, Rhea Carr.
Hi.
Let's talk about Mint Creek Farm. You guys are based in what I kind of know of as a hotbed of permaculture in the state, and that's Stell, Illinois. I assume it's not an accident that you're down that way.
Well, not as much as anything else is an accident, no. our location has ended up working out pretty well for us. We are not actually affiliated with I think you're referring to the
Midwest permaculture. Yeah.
But we are right by them, and that's smack in the middle of north central Illinois. I call it the middle of nowhere. so that's where Mint Creek Farm is. We're 220 acres of certified organic prairie pastures. And we've been working on developing, growing our farm since I was about two. That's when it all started. It's my parents' farm. And they actually started it as a hobby. They were wanting to get back to the land, wanting to look at alternatives for conventional farming, chemical farming, which surrounds us in that area. You know, it's kind of one of those Midwest areas where it's corn and corn and corn and then some beans.
Yeah.
And some more corn. It's evolved a lot over the years. We sell around the Chicago area primarily and primarily directly to our customers, but we are lucky to work with co-ops and small grocers in addition to some smaller restaurants as well. So
let me just say, I think it's kind of interesting, though, that you say you're not connected to Midwest permaculture, but there you are in the same area as they are. And that's just sort of an interesting coincidence, that because your missions are very, very similar, I would think.
We are also lucky to be close to the Greenhouse Bed and Breakfast. We partner with them for farm tours and dinners. They're just a huge support to our farm. And then we also partner with Kilgis Farmstead, which is over a little ways farther away, but also still close, in Fairbury, Illinois. They are a small family-run dairy. We have some great neighbors. We're also fairly close to, you probably have heard of, Genesis Growers. They're an organic vegetable farm. So there's more going on in the region than one might think, which is really exciting.
One of the things I want to ask you about is the Good Food Business Accelerator. What is that about, and why are you involved? Because, and the reason I ask that is, as you say, your parents put this farm together a while ago. This has been going on for several decades. And why is it you're now working with Family Farms Good Food Business Accelerator? What do you hope to get out of it?
We were a part of the Good Food Fest, we have been, not every single year, but most years in some way or another. For instance, this year we're also a part of the CSA pavilion there, because our farm has a meat and dairy CSA. And then my dad, Harry, who's we call him Emeritus Farmer, he's spoken on some of the panels over the years, too, or at the Good Food Fest. And he's the one that Jim called him up, and Jim Slama, that is, and just to see if he was interested in the Good Food Accelerator. So initially we were talking about specifically the lack of organic poultry processing in the area and trying to create a brainstorm on that. But, after applying and getting accepted to the the Good Food Business Accelerator, and kind of looking at the business side of our farm, it became clear that there was resources that would help us focus on growing our farm and making it into more of a sustainable business, which is something that I think a lot of smaller farm businesses struggle with the business side of things. I mean, they think of themselves more as farmers oftentimes and less of business people. And it's often a passion of heart to start a small farm, a lot of work for little pay, with idealistic reasons behind it. So the business side of things can kind of go by the wayside pretty easily. But then that's not sustainable, is it? So I think that's really great that the Good Food group, the Family Farm, made a pivot and offered the Business Accelerator, because it not only have they had great presenters in it, people from all different sides of business there to talk to us about their experiences and educate us, but it's also connected us as small businesses, and we've really been able to learn and grow and help each other. And it's that great sense of community too, not just being in this alone. So I'm really excited and grateful for it, especially considering it's the first year of the Business Accelerator. Just really impressed by what we've gotten out of it.
Has that brought you closer to some of the businesses in Chicago? Has that helped you make connections?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of potential. I'm pretty intrigued to see if we might partner with some of the businesses in the accelerator, and we've started to talk a little bit about some things we might work together on. It's really brought home how fruitful it can be to focus on the financial sustainability of our business, because that's something that's constantly wearing on us. And
of course,
it's nice to have something that kind of forces there to be a spotlight on just making it all work.
Yeah, and let's face it, farming's a tough business. It's a tough racket, as they say. But let me get to something else here. I'm going to surprise you a little bit here, because I went to your website and I found this. Let me play a little bit of it.
Organic pricing concerns, still below chemotherapy. Pure but pompous, my mind starts to atrophy. Hay prices have doubled. What are we to feed? Without a bull, our cows won't breed. Lambs are popping, 30 of 500 so far. Feeding them through winter sure will be hard. I'm Harry Carr from Mint Creek Farm, located in Stell, Illinois, about an hour and a half south of Chicago. We started with 50 acres and 10 head of sheep, and now we have sheep and goats, cows and pigs, chickens and ducks, raised turkeys for Thanksgiving. We're grazing probably somewhere close to 1,000 head on pasture, and we raise these for meat, sell the meat in farmers markets and stores in Chicago. Then we had no rain. The wind did blow.
So I'm going to stop it there. That is your dad, Harry Carr. Is that him?
Yes.
Okay. The farmer poet. That's pretty interesting. And I imagine not many farms have a farmer poet on board.
Yeah. We are a pretty special farm to have a farmer poet on board.
the point I want to make, though, is, okay, at Mint Creek Farm, you raise premium grass-fed meats, and you graze your livestock on certified organic pasture. You have grass-fed lamb, grass-fed beef, pastured pork, pasture-raised goat. And yet, here you got this guy who's very philosophical about all this. And, you know, I was looking at the video, and you can see the animals, the livestock running through the grass and out there in nature. There's what I'm bringing up is this dichotomy, I guess, between the pastoral aspect of it and the fact that it's a meat-producing farm. And I bet you get that stirs a lot of controversy among your vegan friends.
Yeah, it does come up in conversation. And it's something that my perspective on has really begun a long time ago and evolved slowly over the years. You know, I mean, as a little kid, I was there working on the farm, taking care of some of the lambs that needed extra attention and the goats, and I'd get really attached to them because they were like my little babies. They were my bottle-fed ones because, you know, some of them, their mom doesn't have enough milk or, for whatever reason, can't take care of them. So, and they would follow me around. They you know my voice. So that's like the extreme of being attached to the animals that are also the meat that we eat. So you can see how I'd end up thinking a lot about eating meat and whether or not it was something I wanted to do, having the where it came from and how it originates be so in my face. And I think about it in terms of the quality of life the animals get. They eat all organic. How many people can say they eat only organic food, first of all?
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
They're also let to be kind of wild out on the pastures. They have big expanses to roam and play on, and they have really great lives. So I feel really good about raising domesticated livestock for meat because I'm seeing they're happy, and we slaughter using the most humane methods. It's very quick, it's just like that's common to human and animal death is.
And I guess you reconcile yourself to that at some point. You begin to understand how that works. And
it's the circle of life, and I think it's a great gift to be able to eat meat that is humanely raised for and in good conditions, and it's highly nutritious. That's really a big part of my life and something I'm very grateful for.
We're talking to Rhea Carr from Mint Creek Farm. The website, by the way, is mintcreekfarm.com. You know, someday I'm going to have this conversation on this show and get more than one person, and we'll sit around and discuss that whole vegetarian versus vegan versus humane meat production. Jody Osmond from Cedar Valley Farm has been on the show, and we've talked about that before, and it's a real interesting question. And I think that it's important what you guys are doing because it is done humanely. And it's not the whole factory farm thing.
No, not at all. Actually, if you don't mind, there's something that's pretty distinct about our farm and how we look at farming that I think fits into your question, of how meat can be, a positive thing. And for us, like in raising animals for meat, we think of the farm as an ecosystem. We think of it in ecological terms. So as far as its environmental effects, we're looking at how to enrich the ecosystem, the soil, the quality of the air through our farming methods. We're not just trying to gain something we can then turn into a product, a commodity, and sell. We're trying to look at the ecosystem as a whole being sustainable and fruitful. And that more concretely is translated in raising biodiverse plants and animals. So instead of just doing one kind of animal, we do a bunch of kinds because they can be symbiotic in how they relate to the pastures. And same thing with our perennials in the pastures. There's a lot of different varieties of plants because they work well together. And then we also have sections of the land that are set aside just for wild, like birds and other creatures. So we're pretty holistic and trying to look at the big picture and the long run of having really sustainable, healthy food.
And you're part of day two of the Good Food Festival and Conference at the UIC Forum. I should mention that it's at the UIC Forum. And I should also mention that the website for more information is Good Food Festivals, with an S on the end, goodfoodfestivals.com. And day two is the Good Food Trade, School, Food, Producer, Policy stuff. includes regional and national leaders in food policy, production, and advocacy. And I see that you're involved in a program called Scaling Up Local Meat. You'll be there, and Gunthorpe Farms will be represented in Slagle Family Farm and the Butcher and Larder, White Oak Pastures. What do you hope to accomplish on that panel?
Oh, well, I was just honored, you know, to be asked to be on it, and I don't have an agenda, but I'm happy to talk about what we do and where we're going with it.
Well, I have to bring up one thing that I noticed. You guys have a connection to, and I'm not sure what it is, so maybe you can tell me, maybe it's not much at all, but the Band of Farmers, that sound familiar?
Yeah, so that is a group that we kind of like help cross-promote our CSA shares. So we're going to be, that's the CSA Pavilion. We're going to have information on our monthly and weekly CSA shares, which, in case listeners aren't familiar, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's sort of like a buying club, but you purchase a set amount to be picked up or delivered over a course of weeks or months. And the payment up front really helps us farmers be able to deal with the upfront expenses we have to deal with as far as feed for our animals and other investments to keep things going. So CSAs are really great, and if you haven't looked into them, I'd highly recommend it.
I think a lot of folks know about CSAs in terms of their vegetables that they purchase, but it's important to know that CSAs are also, you can get involved in a meat CSA, which is yours.
Yeah, our CSA is pretty cool. It's a fairly small program, and we really listen to what our customers want and do our best to customize it as much as possible while it's still being a CSA. We have a ton of different options, anywhere from just lamb and goat or just pork and poultry once a month CSA shares to our weekly deliveries that include dairy from Kilgis Farmstead, and then meat and milk from our farm, from Mint Creek Farm. That's an assortment of what's been freshly butchered. And we even offer home delivery. So that's pretty unique. And
yeah,
it's been very popular since we started offering it.
Well, that's interesting, because what I was going to ask earlier is, because you mentioned that you deliver to restaurants and co-ops in the Chicago area, but then you also deliver to individuals?
Yes, we do. We deliver CSAs to individuals, and you can also make a custom order of specific meat cuts and or our organic eggs.
Wow, that's fantastic. Getting back to the Band of Farmers, I don't suppose you're involved in the talent show at all.
Oh, well, you can guess that it's the farmer poet that's probably going to be performing in the talent show. So, we had to do it we had to do the CSA Pavilion, if nothing else, so you could perform in the farmer talent show. So
the farmer poet will be involved in the farm. Yeah, and I was just looking at it because they have a Facebook page if you're interested. It is, I believe it's just Band of Farmers on Facebook if you want to see their information. And every year, or, well, it's only been a couple of years, but I believe that there's a talent show coming up again this year that, let's see, where will that be? Is that the 28th or something like that? Yeah, third annual CSA Farmer Talent Show on March 28th at the Hideout.
Yeah, it's a really fun event. You'd be amazed at what good performers farmers can be. I don't know how there's time for it to have a hobby amidst everything, but I was really impressed with the performances. And especially the general sense of humor. You got to have a sense of humor if you're going to do something like farming. So that was really fun last year.
Yeah, I would think so. So it's March 28th, Saturday. The doors open at 6 p.m. The show's at 7 p.m. It's at the Hideout in Chicago. And it's only $15. And if you want to see a bunch of farmers perform, that's how you would do it. Before I let you go, let me just remind folks that we're talking to Ray Akar from Mint Creek Farm. You guys have events on the farm, too. I was looking that I think you have one coming up, not too distant
yeah,
future.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure to mention that. We started this last year. We had an Easter at the farm event, and we're doing it again this year. So what it is a multi-course fancy brunch at the Greenhouse Bed and Breakfast, which is just a half mile away from our farm. We start there, and we have an excellent guest chef, from Home Bistro. That's Victor Morenz. He's going to be making the brunch. And he buys, actually, from our farm every week for his restaurant. So that's pretty cool that he's going to be coming out to the farm. And then after the brunch, there's a tour of all the different groups of animals, and this is the time of year for baby animals, so it's kind of perfect for Easter. There'll be lots of opportunities to see the baby lambs and baby cows, baby goats, and also an Easter egg hunt.
It sounds like a lot of fun, I'm gonna have to stop by your one of your tables, because I noticed that you're at the Logan Square Farmers Market, and that's my neighborhood. So you guys are there every Sunday, I understand, during the summer.
We are, and they have an indoor market. The indoor season's actually almost over, but it goes through the end of March inside what used to be Pierre's Bakery, just south of Diversity and Kimball intersection on Milwaukee Avenue.
And I see you're at the 61st Street Indoor Market. And the Green City.
Yeah, we're there this Saturday.
Yeah, and then the outdoor markets, Evanston Downtown Market, Horner Park Market, 61st Street Market, Green City Market, Logan Square Market, Glenwood Sunday Market, and Wicker Park Bucktown Market. So that's quite a few places. Well, folks who are listening who live in the Chicago area can stop by. Rhea, thank you so much for talking to me. Have a great time at the Good Food Festival, I hope a lot of people find out about your operation.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.